Log Talk Radio.
Golden dreaming beauty man, if it's only fantasy. Sometimes one can't help but wonder, will it ever truly be? Some people keep on saying, all is illusion and lies. Why is it so hard to believe there are better days to see? So it seems like the world is tumbling down. It's the darkest time of night, right before dawn. Here comes the time of the dawn. Here comes
yes, here it comes, blessed souls. We've been blessed to stay alive by the Almighty Creator in Torah Chaim. Instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You're now tuned into blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we have the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. We call ourselves Soul Class, and this happens to be Soul Class 588, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, program presentation number 136. Blesses our Creator, shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the entire human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting at 9:31 a.m. on March 31st, 2016. Live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA Unified Soul Actualization. Program content will involve discussions on the following topics. Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on this day all the springs of the great deep were split and the windows of heaven opened up. We'll also be turning to Proverbs chapter 4, verse 1. Children, hearken to the discipline of the father, listen to no understanding. Teachings from Rambam, Breslov / Chabad Hasidus, and reading from Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan's seminal work, The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics, the Noahide Laws, which can be purchased by going to www.kehot, that's K-E-H-O-T-O-N, line.com. And from there, you just go into the search engine there at the Kehot online bookstore and type in either Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan, that's C-O-W-E-N, or you can type in The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics and Noahide Laws. Our call-in number is 347-838-8666. Sorry, 8347-838-8669. If you want to listen or maybe even call in to participate in an organic fashion. Meanwhile, may the eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. The tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Universal Redemption, and Written and Oral Traditions of Israel. And last but not least, the Children of Israel collaborating with the Children of Noah to eliminate hatred, jealousy, and competition, which is absolutely unnecessary. For those three hallmark traits will be absent in the days of the Messiah, the Messianic era. And anyone who promotes otherwise is promoting an ideology, a theology, the opposite of the fundamental teachings of Torah from the oral Torah tradition, as transmitted to us to it, an authentic descendant of Kings David and Solomon, Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. In order to begin today's program, we have to reduce the music and end it succinctly of Isaac Bitton, the president of the Beit Mazal congregation, House Good Fortune congregation here in Crown Heights, where you can hear and observe Rav Isaac and his wonderful congregation under the spiritual leadership of Rav Daniel Mapur chant out authentic Jewish North African chantings, cantillations, chazonas, chazanut, fused together with ancient Israelite liturgy formulated by the prophets and sages of Israel. So let's just turn on the music, and oh, here we go, everybody's like, oh, that's the end of that one that section. Now, I want to mention that, unfortunately, today we won't have Rambam, teacher, student, disseminator, and advocate, but the dispersing into the creation for each and every nation in this generation, teachings of Rambam, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, and Nesher Gadol, the great eagle, Dennis Ryan, who mentioned to me yesterday that he has some logistical matters to take care of that are private, and he might join us in a most spontaneous way, and if he doesn't, well, then hopefully he'll join us next week. Blessed Soul says, well, we want to send out requests before all of creation, each and every nation, this generation, to the Almighty, of course, who knows everything before we even say it, that today's program is dedicated to the speedy recovery and the healing of the vertebrae, which is still paining my father in the thoracic section of his body, and for the strengthening of the spirit and soul and resolve of my mother, Maras Yiska Bas Chayesar Aliyah Shalom, and of course for my father, Reb Shlomo Yaakov Shiyichia Ben Esther Aliyah Shalom, Esther being his mother, my grandmother, blessed memory. As well, we want to send a shout out and well wishes to Achatan Vakala, a new family amongst the nation of Israel, Rev Yecheskel Halevi Siegel, and his Ashes Chayel, Maras Ada Arava Siegel, and may they have a binyan aliyad, an everlasting edifice amongst the Jewish people, Badarchim Darchi Sholom. And the Shekhinah should always be with them and dispersing outwardly from within themselves to outside of the house and whatever communities they'll be living in or the community they'll be living in. And for all, of course, for the this should be recognizable by other human beings who interact with them. As well, I want to send a shout-out and well wishes to my father-in-law and mother-in-law, Reb Shabtai Hillel, Shiichia, and Maras Rivka, Techia, and to my brother-in-law, Harav Avraham, Ben Avraham Shiichia, and to his Eishes Chayel, my sister-in-law, Anat Hillel Ben Avraham Techia, and to my brother-in-law, Daniel Moshe Shiichia. Okay, blessed souls, let's now start, as we usually do, with a letter from Lubavitcher Rebbe. Terse, but yet very powerful. And it's based on an introductory teaching from the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rebbe Dov Ber, which was gleaned out of a seminal work by the sixth Rebbe, the Rebbe Rayatz, Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson of Lubavitch, who the Rebbe quoted in this letter. And he was writing to someone back in 5712, which would correspond either to the end of 1951 or the beginning of 1952. So we're talking about a letter that's around 64 years ago. In reply to your question, the difference between God is all and all is God is in the approach and the deduction. In the first instance, our starting point is God, Creator, and through study and research, we deduce that Creator's being is revealed even in material and natural things. Our study of the all-embracing unity of Creator and his other attributes will lead us to recognize the same attributes in nature and the world all around us, the practical results of which find expression in unity among mankind, or womankind, humankind, whatever you want to say, and the practices of Creator's precepts or commandments as the proper application of Creator's attributes in our own lives. One who sets out on this path dedicates himself wholly to communion with God. He is averse to all material aspects of life, including even the bare necessities connected with his or her physical well-being, and tries to avoid them as much as possible. Now, being engaged in spiritual communion with Creator, he sees all material and physical necessities, even those recognized by the Torah, as a hindrance to his or her life of self-abnegation. However, his intelligence or her intelligence convinces him or her that the material physical world is but an expression of the divine being, and that in it too, Creator is to be found. So, in the point of God is all, that's how the Rebbe expressed it in response to this person's question. Now, relating to the second part of the statement we mentioned above, quote unquote, all is God, the starting point is the outer shell of the universe and all material things in it, a study which will lead to the conclusion that the whole world is part of a cosmic unity and that there is a divine, quote unquote, spark that vitalizes everything and that consequently there is only one creator. Hence, it follows that he or she serves Creator even while engaged in the material aspects of life, and he or she does so with joy, realizing that it is in them and through them, the materiality that he or she are engaging in, that he or she can recognize the greatness of the Creator, and that the materiality, the corporeal aspects of our life, are in fact instrumental in strengthening his or her unity with Creator. Thus, we have two approaches towards the service of Creator, the first of which is easier, while the second leads more completely to the fulfillment of the objective to make this, the lowest physical world, an abode for godliness. What a wonderful teaching to hopefully inspire us to reevaluate where we are at this very moment or where we will be at the time we hear this teaching from a direct descendant of King David and Solomon, Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, the last couple of weeks, actually last week we didn't do a program because it was Purim last week. I hope everyone who observed Purim, or at least learned about Purim, had a wonderful time that day. And we're going back to tarry a little bit more on this verse in Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, which reads, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th of the day, on this day, all the springs of the deep well, of the great deep, were split and the windows of heaven opened up. As we mentioned when we initially started to dialogue on this verse, we mentioned that there are various sub-subject matters within this one long verse. There's the amount of years of Noah's life. That's issue number one. In the second month, that's issue number two. On the 17th of the month, that's the third issue. On this day is the fourth issue. The fifth issue and the springs of the wellspring were split. And number six, and the windows of the heavens opened up. Now bear in mind, blessed souls, these are not poetic historical depictions. This is a prophetical teaching, which was translated, not to Noah to write down, or Noah probably didn't have to write down because he experienced it, but actually transmitted to Moses, although he might have heard the oral tradition from his father Amram. He was told this in a prophetic fashion by the Creator. So, looking into the oral Torah traditions, what is the significance of the point the Torah teaches us? That it mentions the second month. Now, there are two context by which we can say something is the second month within a Torah, written in oral Torah tradition. Within the context of the flood, there's also the understanding that the flood took place in Mar Cheshvan, which is the month which follows the month of Tishrei, which is the seventh month in relation to the first month of the year in relation to the first month of the month, which is in Nisan, which we're rapidly approaching as we get ready for the Passover holiday. In the month of Tishrei, that's where we spend our time in a metaphoric arc, sort of safety zone within our consciousness, with the hope that with the incoming new year, as it relates to years, the numeration of the years on the Hebrew solar calendar, I should say Hebrew lunar calendar year, actually, the lunar calendar is actually something which preceded the Hebrew Israelite Jewish people. In the lunar calendar benchmark beginning of the year, which is called Rosh Hashanah, and then from there we go to the high holidays that follow it, particularly Yom Kippur and then other days of holiness, Sukkot and Simchat Torah, the day that we rejoice the Torah because we fill another year's cycle of reading the entire Torah. It is the custom of the nation of Israel to read the entire Torah from Shabbat to Shabbat for a whole year, and then finally to various applications of when to read it in the month of Tishwa. We finally finished reading the entire Torah, the last portion in Deuteronomy, Devarim, on Simchat Torah. And only in the following month, Mar Cheshvan, which when the flood took place, historically, that's the second month talked about in this verse, Blessed Souls, do we return, so to speak, to ordinary mundane lives. And although this progression appears to be a spiritual descent, there is in fact an advantage to the mundane lives we resume in Mar Cheshvan, since we fulfill the goal of creating a divine home in this world specifically by infusing mundane existence with divine consciousness. And that's me gleaning from Lakuti Sikhos, volume 20, pages 289-290, which again is the whole idea of all is God. Even in our mundanity, we can elevate it back to Creator, and that gives us more enthusiasm. The other day I was speaking to someone, they were telling me they sometimes, although they have a certain issue where they got involved in certain behaviors which they knew were potentially life-threatening, and at certain points of life were life-threatening to this person, that they've given them up. But at the same time, too, now that they've lived, they're now living a pretty thoroughly observant Torah life, this person finds that there are many dull moments in this person's life. But with the infusion of the awareness of this teaching, that everything, all is Hashem, that in the very physicality that we're engaging in, is how we can access through the process of human reasoning that there's no way that we can drink the liquids that we drink and eat the solid foods that we intake of and the clothes that we wear if not there was a spark of godliness that enlivens that matter, just as empty space is enlivened by the sparks of the Creator, the light of the Orin Sof, the infinite light of Creator. Something to think about, blessed souls. And where the verse went on to say as well, the great and the springs of the great depth, and the whole idea of the windows of heaven opening up, here is alluding to that the raging waters, which came from below and from above, refer to the worries that flood a person's mind. These worries can take two forms. The great abyss, these are worries over lowly material matters, such as finances. Then there are the floodgates of the heavens. These are worries over more spiritual and lofty matters, such as community service, which in fact impede a person from studying the Torah and fulfilling the commandments. While it is, of course, important to be involved in community service, it must not come at the expense of Torah study and observing the commandments. For it is precisely through observing the commandments that a person connects to Creator and therefore earns his assistance, meaning Creator comes to assist us, man, woman, and child, any human being. Therefore, the argument that we are too busy to perform God's commandments, Creator's commandments, the mitzvot, because we're inundated by the quote-unquote floodgates of the heavens, we're busy saving the world, which is in fact a matter of great lofty spirituality. This is something, in fact, that our divine soul, that divine spark that's within us, for the divine spark within us would never put forth an argument that contradicts the Torah, which requires us to fulfill the commandments regardless of our inundation with communal matters. When such an argument occurs to us, we should be aware that it is being voiced by our ego, which thinks it has found the perfect excuse to avoid performing our Torah-mandated obligations. Rather, it is only by maintaining a proper balance between our communal activism and personal faith-based observance of the 613 commandments and also the seven additional rabbinically ordained from the oral tradition commandments, or the seven Noahide commandments, which are actually core commandments, and there's actually more than seven, that we can hope to succeed in both those lofty spiritual matters, those floodgates of the heavens, those windows of the heavens being opened up upon us to help other people, and growing as individuals to exemplify that which we are seeking to share with others, to be on the mission to illuminate the eyes of others. But if we are not illuminated ourselves, then truly the message we send or project out into the world is a, in fact, watered down one, blessed souls, and that's not our intent to do so. It's not, I mean, in my own humble efforts, that's what I'm trying to elevate within myself, to make that balance between, for instance, getting involved in these humble efforts here of being a radio cyberspace librarian or Torah Askan, Torah activist, with on the net and off the net, my interpersonal experience with other people. There's a balance. You have to implement, but you have to know how to implement it. It's very practical. Now, Dennis, since unfortunately has not been able to come on with the program, and I look forward to having him on next week, so I'm going to take over him and read something from Shmona Prochim of the Rambam, the 13 Principles of Faith, the 8 chapters of the Rambam, which is preface to his elucidations on the teachings of the ethics of our fathers. And it goes like this. We'll step right into chapter 7. Know that a prophet will not prophesize. And of course, we know there was, and speed in the days, there should be the manifestation of prophetesses, Navi, Naviim and Naviot. Know that, but we'll use it in the masculine form for now. Please, we're not trying to be sexist. A female can prophesize as well as a male. And that's a Torah axiomatic teaching that one just has to learn more about, and I'll leave that up to you, blessed souls, to do your homework on the matter. But again, we'll speak in the masculine just for the sake of brevity. Know that a prophet will not prophesize until he has acquired all the intellectual virtues and most, even the most formidable of the ethical virtues. This is implied by our sage's statement, quoting from the Talmudic tractate of the Oral Torah tradition of Shabbat 92a, quote, "The spirit of prophecy will rest solely on a wise man who is valiant and wealthy." And now the Rambam is going to recapitulate what the sages are intending on a broader base. So we shouldn't just get very black and white track minded concerning this very terse statement of our sages. The spirit of prophecy will rest only on a wise man who is valiant and wealthy. So Rambam defines the term wise man surely includes all the intellectual virtues which we do expect of a person who is wise, which is enumerated in part in certain sections of Perkei Avot, the ethics of our fathers. Now the term wealthy is not just someone who has a physical bounty, I mean a lot of money in the bank account or a big IRA account or a lot of gold stock somewhere, a Swiss bank account. The term wealthy includes also, as Rambam asserts, all ethical virtues. And the Rambam learns out even deeper. This refers to a quality of satisfaction. Our sages would call a person who is satisfied wealthy, as they taught in, guess where, in the Ethics of Our Father, Perkei Avot, Chapter 4, Mishnah 1. Who is rich? One who is happy with his portion. Meaning, one who is happy with what fortune presents him and does not grieve over what fortune does not present him. Similarly, where the Rambam, the sages mentioned in the Talmudic tractate 92a, the person who is valiant refers to an ethical virtue, the ability to direct one's potentials in congruence with one's thoughts. As we explain in chapter 5, this is implied by our sages' statement, again, quoting from the Perkei Avot, who is rich, one who is happy with his portion. What is implied, the Rambam is telling us, who is valiant, one who conquers his natural inclination. It is not necessary for a prophet to have mastered all the ethical virtues to the point that he does not possess any shortcomings at all. And proof of this is given by a very wise man, King Solomon, who was a prophet, as the verse states, in the book of Kings 1, chapter 3, verse 5, at Givon, Creator appeared to Solomon. And yes, we do find in the written Torah and oral Torah traditions, we find explicit references to Solomon, King Solomon, Shlomo Melech, having certain ethical shortcomings, overindulgence. He had many wives. This comes as a result of the trait of overindulgence. Scripture explicitly censures him for this, as it said in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 13, verse 26, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin in this matter? Similarly, David was a prophet, as it was written in the book of Samuel 2, chapter 23, verse 3, the God of Israel said to me, the Rock of Israel spoke. Nevertheless, we find that he was hard-hearted. Although he directed this quality against the Gentiles who made war against Israel in those days and killed those who denied God and was merciful to the Jews, we nevertheless find in Chronicles that God did not find him fit to build the temple because of the many people he killed. As is written in the book of Chronicles, chapter 22, verse 8, you will not build a house for my name because you shed much blood earthward before me. And Rambam continued as another example of a prophet who is not perfect in all of their ethical virtues. None other than Elijah the prophet. For Elijah the prophet possessed the trait of anger, as Rambam continued. Although he directed against the non-believers and would focus his wrath on them, our sages explain in the Talmudic tractate of Sanhedrin, page 113, side B, and the Yalkut Shmoni, volume 2, in Kings, and then in Kings, section 217, which describe Elijah as prone to anger and rage. Indeed, this is evident from the biblical narrative itself. That his wrath was to the point that our sages explain that God removed him from the world, telling him that a person with his degree of zealousness is not fit to live among people, lest he cause them to be destroyed. Similarly, Samuel had shortcomings, as emphasized by his fear of Saul, which is recorded in the book of Samuel 1, chapter 16, verse 2, and Jacob feared Esau, which is mentioned in the book of Genesis 32, verse 8. However, despite having these shortcomings, these prophets mentioned above were able to convey the word of Creator, and they were vehicles for receiving the word of Creator. The undesirable attributes they possessed, nevertheless, were like veils for them. Whoever had two or three qualities that deviated from the mean, as explained, as Rambam had previously explained in chapter 4 of this work, would see Creator behind two or three veils. As we conclude in this section on the Rambam, do not wonder at the fact that a person's shortcomings with regard to his ethical development will reduce the level of his prophecy. For indeed, we find that the lack of ethical development can prevent prophecy entirely. For example, anger, as our sages said, in the Talmudic tractate of Pesachim, the oral Torah tradition of how to observe the Passover holiday, page 66, verse quote, whoever displays anger, if he is a prophet, his prophecy will depart from him. They derive this concept from the narrative regarding Elisha, who did not receive a vision from Creator until he purged himself of anger, and therefore he requested, as written in the book of Kings 2, chapter 3, verse 15, bring me a musician. Similarly, worry and melancholy prevent prophecy, the Rambam asserts, as reflected by the fact that the spirit of prophecy did not rest upon Jacob throughout the years he mourned for Joseph until he received word that he was alive. Thus the verse, as mentioned in Genesis 45, chapter 45, verse 27, and the spirit of Jacob, their father, was revived, is rendered by the Targum, which explains the interpretations received through the tradition from Moses as, quote-unquote, and the spirit of prophecy rested on Jacob, their father. So the revival of a person of such elated spiritual quality, the revival was dependent on him receiving once again the spirit of prophecy. As we conclude this section, our sages commented in two Talmudic tractates, Shabbat, p. page 30, side B in Pesachim. Again, the oral Torah tradition of how to keep the Passover. Page 117, side A. Prophecy does not rest amidst laziness or sadness, only amidst joy. That's a very important point, Blessels. Even though most of us, if not 99% of all of us, 99.99% of us, are not prophets, not seeking to prophesy. Still, let's learn from those who are on very high spiritual levels. They, in order for them to be vessels to reflect out the word of the Creator, they avoid laziness, they avoid sadness, and they emphasize the wonderful human experience of living the joyous state of mind. There's an oral Torah tradition that sometimes I like to review in my mind. It's so terse and it's so powerful, so spiritually powerful, so dense with all of its implications for lifting up not ourselves, but for those who we interact with. A Lev Tov Mishta Tamid. I believe the Rambam even wrote about this. A person who possesses a good heart is feasting continually. And I'll leave that up to you to define how you would like to feast continually. Well, maybe you'd like to go to a smorgasbord for Chinese food, or, you know, and all your, whatever is in your mind's eye and your palate's sensitivity, a feast, a bounty. But before you put any drink into your mouth or morsels of food into your belly, make sure you're being satiated by Tov, the goodness of heart that it can exist within you. But again, you have to want it to be there, blessed souls. Now, let's move on to Proverbs chapter 4, verse 1. As we start a new chapter in the teachings of Solomon, which are prophetic instruction. Children, hearken to the discipline of the father and listen to no understanding. Metzudah David was one of the great sages of the nation of Israel. Wants us to know via the following statement. You, the children of the living God, hearken to the discipline of the Father in heaven, and our Father in heaven, who disciplines concerning the understanding, and listen to know it. Now, Ibn Nachmiash explains the verse on a much more simpler level. As the teacher who instructs his or her disciples concerning the understanding of the Torah. In the previous chapters of the Proverbs, which we've covered now up until today, the first three chapters in this series, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, the father rebuked the son, and in this chapter, the teacher admonishes his disciples, who are also known as children. And we see here that this matter is dealt with as well in the Book of Kings 1, chapter 20, verse 35, referring to the disciples of the prophets. Indeed, from a certain perspective, the teacher is higher than the father, since the teacher, by teaching Torah to the children of other human beings, assists and empowers his or her pupils access Olam Abba, the world to come, whereas the father, and let's mention the mother as well, because she is part of the process of bringing children to the world, in essence, while the father just has a seminal moment to do what he has to do, to pass his seed to her, and where she carries it for 9 months with all the travails involved and the suffering and the joy, joyful tears. Of course, there are many parents, and we have tried to do the best with our children. We share Torah teachings with our children, but in essence, because of our need to sustain ourselves, because we're still living in an exile condition, we have to leave our children in the hands of teachers and school systems. And for those who can homeschool their children, all the blessings to you. And may the Creator strengthen you and exemplify for all of us on a continual basis how more and more people can do it if people are not finding satisfaction with the way their children are being educated in either secular institutions or even faith-based institutions. That being said, now we're going to turn to a wonderful website, which is www.breslov.org, and I'm going to be gleaning from a Torah teaching by Rav Yossi Katz, which is referring to this week's Torah portion. And this portion from this section of this website from Breslov.org is called Pathways Crossing the Narrow Bridge with Rabbi Nachman and his students, again by Rav Yossi Katz. And this is basically him gleaning from teachings from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. What would life be if everything was just, you know, fun and games? Many dream about such an existence, the drudgeries of a day job, the responsibilities of raising a family, and the endless tasks at home make the easy life sound so appealing. But would throwing away all of life's difficulties and just having fun be so great after all? Of course, Rabbi Nachman famously taught that it is a great mitzvah to be always happy, to be joyous. Huh. So not only did the prophet, as we just mentioned before, always seek to be happy and avoid laziness and sadness in order to be vehicles for prophecy, blessed souls, it's a mitzvah from the Torah. It's a great mitzvah, Rabbi Nachman tells us, always be happy. Curiously, the Rebbe explained that sometimes it's not enough to just act in a joyous manner and let sorrow or anxiety melt away on their own. Sometimes one must forcefully transform pain and sorrow into joy and happiness. And this is mentioned, the source for this assertion by Rabbi Nachman can be found from his Likutei Maharan, Volume 2, Instruction 23. The reason for this is that there are elements of pain and sorrow that refuse to become a platform for holiness. When we have a good time and act joyfully, these elements refuse to take a permanent leave. They later return to haunt us, never allowing us to reach an optimal level of happiness. A great example of living with permanent spiritual bliss is Nadav and Avihu, who are none other than the two sons of the high priest of Israel, Aaron, who served as Kohanim in the tabernacle when the 12 tribes of Israel were in the desert. They made a conscious choice not to marry because the thought of dealing with all the mundane aspects of married life did not appeal to them. They preferred to live a worry-free spiritual existence, but they met their match when they were unable to perform an essential part of the tabernacle service, the bringing of the incense offering, the ketores. Now, if you do a little research on the matter, but we'll just say it in a general manner, the ketores was a mixture of 11 spices that was offered up to Creator. It had two distinct features. First, one of its ingredients was galbanum, something that is terribly foul-smelling. Secondly, offering the ketores was the single greatest way to uplift the holy sparks from the lowest of places on earth. These two features are very much connected. The ketores embodies the idea of transforming pain and sorrow into joy and happiness. The foul-smelling galbanum represents the sorrow found in the lowly places in the world. When included with other spices, its foul odor is transformed to create a heavenly aroma. However, the two sons of Aaron, HaKohen, high priest of Israel, Nadav and Avihu, never married. Happy as they were with their spiritual existence, when they released the foul odor of galbanum, they lacked the tools. And though Rav Katz doesn't say what type of tools, let's project out they lacked the intellectual, spiritual, and emotional tools to deal with this challenge. Pain and sorrow are an extension of death and bereavement, which is why these emotions are experienced at those times. The sorrow of the galbanum overcame Nadav and Avihu to the point of their unfortunate, untimely death. Rav Katz brings out now the following question. It's a very strong one. So how can we force the elements of sorrow to be elevated to the point of holiness and joy? We can turn them on their head by recognizing that if I feel sad right now, because of my lowliness, then shouldn't I be happy that even a low life like myself can accomplish some measure of goodness? For example, if I am sad because I feel so far away from Creator, isn't it amazing that Creator must love me so that He helps me do so many commandments, like giving of tzedakah, giving of charity, wearing tzitzis, if you're a Jew, saying psalms, any human being can do so, and many more, the 7 Noahic commandments, the 613 commandments. Rabbi Nachman was once speaking with someone who complained bitterly about his terrible behavior. In fact, this man wanted very much to draw close to Creator and change his behavior for the better. But each time he tried, his temptations grew stronger and stronger. The days turned into years, and the man grew dejected. The Rebbe said, quote, "Then I have no one to speak to because everything is totally bad." At this point, the man got excited and exclaimed, quote, "But I do have to try to fight back at times and get to closer what I should be as a Jew." The Rebbe knew that the only way to restore this Jew's spirit was by helping him feel that if the argument of the sorrow was really true, therefore the ambivalence validating his feelings, which is a potent tool used in counseling, and being someone who's in social service, I can tell you that this is done a lot, and I'm trained in it. I've observed people do it, and the clients I work with appreciate when their feelings are validated, even when they're feeling sorrow and empty and lonely and feel like giving up. Validating their feelings gives them a point to help them realize they're not alone. But from that point of not being alone and having their feelings validated, Rabbi Nachman did in this case, this empowered this unfortunate man, that he too finally possessed enough perspective to appreciate his good points in contrast to his destitute spiritual nature. When we too come to this recognition, there is hope indeed. What a beautiful teaching by Rabbi Nachman. Thank you, Harav Yosef Katz. Now we're going to move on to some Chabad Chassidus, gleaning from the second portion of Lakuti Diborim, a gleaning of talks, an anthology of talks by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson of Lubavitch. These are truly fundamental teachings. And the Rebbe goes on to say, those who have studied or heard a word or two of Chassidus know that teshuvah is not what the workaday world considers it to be. Teshuvah meaning repentance, as the world would understand it, naming something that comes in the wake of transgression, but is in fact a path in the service of God, of Creator. Knowing this will enable us to understand an observation that the Alter Rebbe once made, the first Chabad Rebbe, that it is conceivable that a person should be a servant of Creator for 70 years, raising evil to the level of the consummate tzaddik, the consummate righteous human being, and yet never having savored the taste of teshuvah, of returning to Creator. Though teshuvah, these aspect of returning, is indeed a path in the service of Creator, it is not the path followed by the truly righteous, because they didn't stray from the path, blessed souls. It's about the teshuvah who has strayed, or the chozim teshuvah, people like myself, who started off in life with not having the proper Torah education, that we are returning on this path. Hence, it is possible, again, as the Rebbe mentioned, the Rebbe Rayatz, that a person should be a consummate tzaddik, yet never having savored the taste of teshuvah, returning. Thus it is, as we mentioned last week's, well, 2 weeks ago, in a humble effort here in search of authentic, ancient, authentic Torah, when Mashiach will come, it is also in order to bring the tzaddikim, even the righteous, to tshuva, to savor the taste of returning. For one of the novelties that will accompany the coming of the Mashiach is that tzaddikim will come to recognize the lofty standing of teshuvah, of returning, as a mode of divine service. When that time comes, whenever a person will attain a perception of divine revelation by means of intellectual cognition, he will be at the corresponding level of avoda. Meaning, today we can attain very high levels of cognitive intellectual awareness of Creator, but that doesn't mean we can implement what we are cognitively aware of in the corresponding level of implementation as it relates to our thoughts and our speech and how much more so our actions. Now, by contrast, when a person grasps a spiritual truth intellectually, he then has to toil in order to make his level of avoda, of implementation, consistent with the level of his intellectual perception and understanding and comprehension. It follows that when in the future tzaddikim will come to appreciate the wondrous worth of teshuvah, returning, as a mode of divine service, their own avoda will then accord with this stance, their own service. Nowadays, the service of the righteous may be summed up in the verse, Asa ha'elokim esa adam yashar, which is quoting from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verse 29, which translates simply, Creator has made man upright. It is a tzaddik, a consummate human being, totally dedicated to righteousness, not straying from the path of Torah and Creator and fellowship with human beings, is totally occupied with how they should conduct his or her life according to the Torah. Concluding in this section, there are two kinds of divine service, avod in the manner of or yasher, direct light, and avod in terms of or chozer, reflected light. In general terms, the difference between the two is as follows. The direction taken by a human engageable service towards Creator and other human beings in the manner of or yasher is from above downwards, and its task is to bring down the revelation of godliness down into the world. The direction taken by avod in the manner of or yasher is from below upwards, its aim being that the world should become a vessel for godliness. Again, that relates to the whole idea of all is God. We're now going to turn to our last section of our program, Blessed Souls, which so far has been a sheer joy and pleasure for me to present it to you, although I do miss Dennis with his pungent commentaries and reading from the Rambam. Particularly, he's very fond of reading from the Guide to the Perplexed, but okay, that's the way things go. Hashkacha Pratis, Divine Providence. So I now conclude with today's presentation of subject matter from this seminal work by Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan, The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics, the Noahide Laws. On page 20, in chapter 1, entitled The Soul by Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan, he quotes from The Rediscovery of Human by Viktor Frankl, who is a psychologist who survived World War II and is most known for the seminal work that he wrote, Man's Search for Meaning. But here we're quoting from The Rediscovery of the Human. In Frankl's words, in responsibility, the goal of human freedom is also given to what a human is free, for what or against what he or she decides. These are specifically the world of meaning and values, the scale of values, and the pivot of summit of every value hierarchy, he asserts, Frankl does, is God or Creator. This beholdenness to something higher than psychophysical elements, the primacy of the spiritual or spirit, is really the benchmark for a truly civilized society. Not a society that claims to be civilized, but allows itself to indulge in barbaric behavior, and consciously and subconsciously allows barbaric behavior to take place amongst the people, its populace. That's not what a civilized society is, according to the values that we're talking about, looking through the prism, the consciousness of one Viktor Frankl, one who suffered so greatly during World War II, losing his first wife to the Nazis, Yavach Shmam, wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, and here The Rediscovery of the human, is promoting the idea that a civilized society must emphasize the spiritual. We shouldn't forget about the psychophysical elements of creation or within every society or within our own private lives. But the primary intent should be to focus on the spiritual. And we have to make some time for the physical as well and the psychological needs of each and every person. Now, this does not include everything which assumes a religious veneer, as Frankl wrote, but rather religion focused on monotheism with the universal values projected by it, to be discussed below. Being civil is not the same as reason by itself. A society could be most scientifically and intellectually developed of its day and even could attach it to some sort of spiritualism, spirituality. But we see that when it did take place in that fashion, it became very distorted and very evil, as evidenced by what took place in Germany as the Nazis rose to power and yet manifested the ultimate in barbarism. Most of humanity now isn't even more so. In the past was religious. I like to say faith-based because I want to remind everyone that in pristine Torah teachings from the written scripture, there is no word for religion. We're observant. We keep the commands. It's okay. Because we're dealing in the context of how people relate to Judaic teachings and other teachings that are spiritually based, the term religion comes up. So we're just, so to speak, using it as a card to get into the social club of human interaction. But how can the concept of image of God within the human be related to the consciously non-religious person? The answer to this, given by Frankl and utilized in his psychotherapeutic work, is that the unconscious spirituality comes into play also in the ostensibly irreligious person if and when one is generally and rigorously it can take place in a genuine and rigorously self-transcending moment, which causes a probing to the deepest why of one's existence. Here Frankl wrote, Creator God is the partner of our most intimate soliloquies. That is to say, whenever you are talking to yourself in utmost sincerity and ultimate solitude, he to whom you are addressing yourself may justifiably be called God. As you notice, such a definition circumvents the bifurcation between atheistic and theistic worldview. The difference between them emerges only later on when the irreligious person insists that his soliloquies are just that, monologues with himself or herself. And the religious person interprets his as real dialogues with something other than himself. Frankl concludes in this section, well, I think that what should come first, more than anything else, is the quote-unquote utmost sincerity and honesty. And I am sure that if God really exists, and I think Frankl did believe he existed, Creator is certainly not going to argue with the irreligious person because they mistake him for their own selves and therefore mistake him. And that's reverting back to the book that we mentioned earlier, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, page 151. Frankl also had written that the non-religious individual who sought meaning at a level which genuinely transcends the claims and interests of the sides of the quote-unquote psycho-physical organism is in fact en route to God without having come to the terminus. Well, we've come to actually the terminus of the conclusion of this program, Blessed Souls. I want to thank you all very much for those of you who are listening to me live all around the world. Or we'll hear this on the archive version. But in order for us to say bye-bye, at least hopefully we'll resume this coming Sunday. Hopefully tonight or tomorrow we'll be programming in. And after I get the final reapproval of three distinguished human beings in our series, which is now hopefully going to be part three in conversation with three distinguished B'nai Noah, namely being Alan W. Cecil, author of Secular by Design, and B'nai Noah scholars Brad Honor and Ron Williams. In the meantime, Blessed Souls, it's been good to talk to you, and that's the name of the song we're going to be ending today's program with, Good to Talk. But Brother David Dome will help us get back home to help us realize and internalize. I tell him Elohim is no dream. Our divine image will help us get off the scrimmage. And I know it's going to, you're going to say, Don, why are you, how come you're trying to, why are you hitting me allegorically and metaphorically on the head with the following statement? You've got to be good. You really have to be good, blessed souls, because it's Tevatov Lehiti. It's the nature of the good to do good, and the Creator is the source of all of our goodness, source of everything that we are. God is all is God. We talked about that earlier at the beginning of the program. This has always been known, but now it has to be shown in a way that we can exemplify to ourselves and others. So go ahead and do something good. Exemplify for yourself and for others that goodness is the ultimate cause that we should be advocating for, doing good and kindness, mercy, where judgment must interface with certain people who have engaged in certain egregious acts. Elements of mercy and kindness also can be intermingled within the judgments that need to be pronounced both thoroughly and openly for those who have violated and betrayed the human family experience. And I'll leave it to you to come up with your own examples of those who have betrayed historically and are actively betraying the human family experience as I speak right now. But again, let us now conclude with, it's good to talk in a way of a havachad, one love, gorlachad, one destiny kulanu for all of us, b'darchinom and darchisham, in a pleasant way, a peaceful way, l'hamshich b'ezer shem yisprek, to be continued with the help of the Most High. Take care, everyone.
about you.